The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you interested in the cutting edge of investing? That means frontier and emerging markets. And would you like to get started? Or perhaps you are already investing but still have questions. Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. On today's program, we'll take a look at news, trends, and background information that you should know to become an informed investor in new and emerging opportunities. Now, here is your host, Gavin Graham.
Hello, and welcome back. This is Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing on Voice America. I'm Gavin Graham, here with you each Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern and 6 a.m. Pacific, also 2 p.m. in the UK. Over the past 3 months, my guests and I have addressed some of the issues and uncertainties around emerging and frontier market investing. We've looked at what works in them right now, why it works, and what we believe will work in the future. I think we've gone through a lot of the confusion and misunderstanding about frontier and emerging markets as an asset class along the way. So where are we now? Well, we're at the halfway point of 2013. Emerging markets certainly haven't covered themselves in glory so far, and we've had various crises rocking the markets in the emerging and frontier zones. But we've also been able to suggest ways in which an investor could play these crises. For example, a few weeks ago, Andrew Lapping at Alan Gray Fund Managers in South Africa suggested now might be the time to look at Egyptian equities in the midst of the uncertainty around the removal of President Morsi by the army. Where are we headed for the rest of the year? No one will want to make definitive predictions, but my guests today are going to look out over the next 6 months and suggest some possibilities. We've asked them for some clues about the rest of the year for both emerging and frontier markets. By emerging markets, we obviously mean the BRIC countries, that's Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And we also include such other major emerging markets as Turkey, Chile, Mexico, and the Czech Republic. Today, my first guest will be looking at the emerging markets category as a whole, and later on, we'll be returning to Mexico to have a look at the auto industry there. By frontier markets, we mean the next generation of emerging markets, countries like Colombia, Vietnam, Nigeria, Kenya, Bangladesh, Kazakhstan, Ghana, Slovenia, and Botswana. Today, I'll be talking to an investment specialist about Colombia and a fund manager about the prospects for Africa. I'm going to get started with Wall Street veteran James Award on the line from New York. He's chairman of Plimsoll Mark Capital, the division of Zephyr Management LP in New York. The two companies have about $750 million in assets under management. He's also a contributor to the book on frontier markets investing that my producer, Al Emmett, and I have completed in time for release this September. Welcome back, James.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Let's talk about where we've been and where we might be going as far as emerging markets are concerned. How would you characterize the first 6 months of this year overall?
Well, it's been a real disappointment. It verges on being a disaster for emerging markets, continuing the trend of 2012. You're probably down around 7-8% in the average emerging market fund, and the U.S. markets are up mid to high teens. So that's a pretty big spread. So significant underperformance.
And one of the reasons for that, obviously, James, has been the slowdown in economic growth in the major emerging markets, such as the BRICS. Is the story the same for all of them, or are there different factors driving each of the individual markets?
Yeah, each one is different. In the case of China, they are in the middle of a structural change in terms of the sources of their growth. They're going from an export and investment-driven growth economy to a slower growth but more enduring growth based on middle-class consumption and spending. So, and they're in the middle of reforms to get them where they need to be. So their growth, they used to grow at 9-10%. You know, these days 7-7.5% is good. In the case of India, they've been a little bit slow on reforms. and both fiscal and monetary and regulatory reform, and that sort of slowed the growth rate. So they're down to about 5% growth. Brazil. Its growth was driven largely by commodity exports to China, and of course China slowing down has now taken the Brazil growth rate to just a little bit above zero. And then Russia is basically a corrupt natural resource driven economy, and that growth has slowed down dramatically. So the BRICS, which people tend to associate with emerging markets, all the major emerging market, all the major BRIC economies have slowed down. That's not to say that other emerging markets haven't grown nicely, but the ones people usually think about, the BRIC countries, have slowed down at a time when the United States has delivered good growth, respectable growth, and so money has flowed out of the emerging markets towards the United States.
Yeah, I mean, as you were saying, James, both Brazil and Russia, to a certain extent, are natural resource plays, which is driven by Chinese demand, and China is slowing down. For the rest of the year, looking forward, do you feel that maybe the Chinese authorities are now starting to relax some of that tightening policy, which caused the slowdown? They feel that maybe the rebalancing towards a more sustainable growth from domestic demand is starting to become apparent, and therefore we might see something of a pickup, because, as you said, that underperformance by emerging markets against the US is enormous, and one would have to think if the US is growing, eventually some of that growth will feed through into markets like the BRICS and the other emerging markets.
Yeah, look, in the long term, the statement you just made is accurate. You know, in those economies, the good ones, 5 to 7% growth is low. Whereas in the United States, if we could get too sustainable, we'd be happy. So the long-term story in select emerging markets remains powerful. But I don't think you're going to see much this year, because I think the rest of the year will be more of the same of what you've got, which is continuing to slow, but maybe stabilizing on the downside in emerging markets, but a little bit of an acceleration in the United States. So I think on a long-term basis, the emerging markets are cheap. They're almost as cheap as they were during the financial crisis. So let's say they're the second cheapest in history. Almost, they're basically as cheap as they were in the crisis in the late 90s. So they're cheap. And if you were to buy today and look back in 5 years and 10 years, I think that you'll have outperformance in the emerging markets versus the United States and developed markets. But I don't think for the rest of 2013 that's going to be the case.
Okay, well, you mentioned some of the other emerging markets apart from the BRICS that actually has been doing quite well. Looking at Asia outside of China, for example, where would you suggest people might be looking at, and which ones have held up somewhat better?
Yeah, well, you know, basically all non-Japan, non-China Asia is attractive. So whether you're talking about South Korea or Thailand or the Philippines, or Malaysia, Vietnam, they're all good long-term growth stories, albeit with market volatility. But I would suggest to investors that they stop thinking about investing in the category called emerging markets, because they're dominated by the four largest economies, and those four largest economies are highly correlated to commodity prices in action, certainly Brazil and Russia are, and so if you just buy an emerging market index, you're going to get highly weighted towards big commodity companies in Brazil and Russia. So what you want to do is you want to think more in terms of investing in good frontier markets through frontier mutual funds that can catch the growth of the middle class and the domestic consumption in those geographies, and that will allow you to capture the growth in China, because everybody in Asia will benefit and grow along with China without some of the near term slowing risks in the economies.
So you mentioned the frontier markets, and that obviously includes some of the South Asian economies, such as Bangladesh and Pakistan, as well as Vietnam, and also, of course, Africa, which is not a continent that features largely in emerging markets, if at all, and yet at the same time seems to have some of the more attractive fundamentals and demographics.
Well, you do have a growing middle class in Africa. The problem is the markets are not deep and transparent. There's a lot of corruption. There's a lot of regulation, and there is huge still emphasis on commodities.
Right.
So I would invest in small and medium enterprises in India before I would invest in Africa. You've got more of a democracy in India. You have terrific demographics in terms of the growth of the younger population. It's fitful because it's a democracy and moves slowly, but I prefer India and Asia to Africa.
Okay. Well, that's fairly clear. What about, to finish up with Latin America, we've talked about Brazil and the fact that there's almost zero growth there this year, although, of course, you do have the Soccer World Cup and the Summer Olympics both coming up in the next 2 to 3 years. But some of the other Latin American markets might look a little more attractive to your point of view?
Yeah, actually, Mexico is doing much better in spite of the headlines about drugs and crime. They're benefiting particularly because much of their economy is hitched to the United States. And Colombia is doing well, and Chile is doing well. I would avoid Argentina and Brazil.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a pretty clear statement. We very much appreciate your talking to us on a regular basis, James, and your outlook for the markets for the rest of the year. And we hope to be back talking to you again soon.
Be my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks. Our thanks to James Aylward at Plimsoll Capital in New York. When I come back from the break, I'll be talking to a fund manager who says frontier markets offer better returns with lower risk than emerging markets, somewhat similar to the point that James was making in the conversation just now, and also insists that Africa is the future. We'll be going to Cape Town, South Africa for that, so please stay with me to hear what he means by those statements.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
This program is produced by EFMI Media, which has become the leader in information about emerging and frontier markets investing. EFMI recently compiled the book entitled Investing in Frontier Markets: Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, set for release by John Wiley & Sons later this year, and another book, also on frontier markets, which will be on store bookshelves later in the year. We are also launching a newsletter called EFMI. For more information, email info@emergingfrontier.ca. For more news about upcoming program segments, the books we have written, or the EFMI newsletter, please email info@emergingfrontier.ca. You can call 416-944-1750.
Are you feeling slammed and suckered in today's stock market? If so, then you need to tune in to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, Jordan Kimmel will train you in what you can do to beat up the big boys on Wall Street, as well as share his secrets to success so that you can buy and sell like a profit-pumping pro. Grab the bull market by the horns and listen to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back. I'm Gavin Graham, and this is Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. We're at the halfway point in the year, And we've been looking at what's happened so far in the emerging and frontier markets and what the outlook of some of our experts' guests are as far as the outlook for the rest of the year. I have Larry Saruma on the line from Cape Town, South Africa. He's Chief Investment Officer and Managing Principal of Nile Capital Management, LLC, which he founded in 2004 and is based in Princeton, New Jersey, and advisor of the Nile Africa Funds. In 2005, the Nile Fund was integrated into a subsidiary of Banco Bilbao Vizcaya Argentaria, and he was named a managing director. Before Nile Capital, Larry worked at Barclays Global Investors and the Chicago Board of Options Exchange. Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, Larry.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me, Gavin. Pleasure to be here.
Great. Some of our other contributors might disagree, as you may have heard in the previous section, but during a recent Bloomberg interview, you suggested that frontier markets such as Nigeria could provide a higher return with a lower risk than some emerging markets. And you've gently taken issue with the belief that frontier funds are more risky than emerging market funds. Could you explain how you came to that conclusion?
When you look at frontier markets and you look at the standard measures of risk like standard deviation over a period of time, you find that frontier markets give you a higher return and a lower risk as measured by standard deviation. So as a result, you are getting a return that is higher than you would expect. So this tends to be a surprise for most investors. But what you tend to find is frontier markets are not correlated with each other. So a country like Kenya is not that correlated to Nigeria because the economies are driven by very different dynamics. So by you investing in those countries, you find that you may end up with a lower risk. But the same is true for the businesses that are operating in the specific individual countries. A consumer business in Nigeria may have a different growth projectile and a different risk characteristic compared to a consumer business in Kenya. So when you construct a portfolio that includes many frontier countries, you end up with lower risk at a portfolio level compared to emerging economies that are much more correlated in their business cycles.
Now, that's certainly a very valuable point, I think, Larry. And of course, frontier markets aren't particularly correlated with developed markets or even emerging markets either. Would you say that from your experience, investors who have been investing in emerging markets and perhaps become accustomed to some of the volatility that goes with investing in emerging markets are more accepting of the volatility that comes with frontier markets?
I think investors need to consider frontier market as a core holding their portfolio, but they need to look at it from a long-term perspective. Frontier markets are not a place to make very short-term investments or very short-term tactical trades, but as a core holding in the portfolio for the long-term investor, it is a good allocation to have that exposure. The real story in frontier market is really growth. Economic growth is more robust, is more sustainable, and these economies are coming off a low base. As a result, you are going to have a much more sustainable high growth environment for a long period of time. And that plays well for long-term investors.
So as you say, a long-term approach is important. That's obviously something that's important looking at your particular speciality of Africa. People have got excited before and been disappointed, but would you agree that Africa is on the verge of a major burst of outperformance? And what leads you to that conclusion, if you do believe that?
Right. The very big conception about Africa is most investors may consider it as a country, but Africa is a continent that has many economies within it. So, for example, where I'm in South Africa, the economy is much slower. It's growing about 2.5%. But when you're in Nigeria, the economy is growing at about 8%. When most people hear about events in Egypt, they believe that that's happening on the entire continent. So they are economies that are growing at a much faster rate. In fact, 7 out of the fastest growing economies are in Africa. And there are some economies that are growing at a lower rate. So, but when you are looking at Africa in total, combining all the different countries and the different investments you can make in those countries, you will end up with a portfolio that has high economic growth and exposed to companies that are growing their top line and the bottom line in double-digit numbers. So that is really the allocation for Africa, and that's how you need to think about it from a country-specific standpoint, and then you can drill down to the actual investment.
And what percentage of international holdings would you recommend investors have in Africa?
My opinion and my own view is that Africa is about 5% of global GDP. So for anyone looking to think about putting together a global portfolio, an allocation based on GDP is probably a very wise starting approach. But for someone who has a much more longer term horizon, then you can look at allocating higher percentages. But again, every allocation has to be done on an individual level, so there's no single one number that fits everyone. But GDP would be the closest proxy that someone can hang, can use.
Now, that's fair enough. How would people go about actually implementing that allocation to Africa? Because obviously, a point made earlier in the program, the actual number of stock markets and the liquidity within those stock markets is obviously not especially high, and people are not very familiar with those markets.
Yes, the best way to do this is through a fund. Shameless plug, but our fund gives you exposure to Africa. But that's the easiest way to really think about Africa, because there are many countries, there are many stock markets, and for the average investor, it's better when he has when he invests with an expat who knows how they can get that exposure and also how they can manage risk in that portfolio.
Okay, and within the different African markets, you mentioned Nigeria a couple of times as being probably amongst the most attractive. Are there a couple of other countries that you feel probably, and which are major weights in your fund, that you feel are attractive?
The best opportunities are in sub-Saharan Africa, and Nigeria ranks high as a key place to invest. Other countries include Kenya, Ghana, Uganda, Rwanda, Botswana, Zambia. So there's quite a few countries that investors can have exposure to that are not in their traditional EM fund, or they're not in their traditional emerging or international market fund.
And just to finish up here, Larry, have you changed your country weightings at all recently to reflect what's been happening as far as the slowdown in China and the fall off in resource prices? Or do you tend to have a relatively low turnover and you're investing for the long term?
We continue to like Nigeria as our largest country exposure on a regional basis. Our focus is sub-Saharan Africa. On a sector basis, we like consumer-related stocks as a long-term play. In addition to that, we like infrastructure-related businesses that are looking to capitalize on logistics or looking to capitalize on building the infrastructure that I believe is a catalyst that is leading to the robust economic growth. In addition to all of that, we are seeing significant investments from the U.S., from China, from South African companies that are looking to do business in Africa, and those are the areas they are focusing on. So you are really having many companies and countries that are really focusing on the same thing.
That's very interesting and very encouraging to hear, Larry. Thank you very much indeed for doing this interview with us. We do appreciate your taking the time, and we hope to have you back to speak about what's been happening and what is going to be happening in Africa again.
Thank you, Gavin. Thank you. I'm really sure.
Cheers. Our thanks to Larry Seruma at Nile Capital, which is based in Princeton, New Jersey, although he's on the line from Cape Town, South Africa. Our next guest is coming from Colombia, Medellin, Colombia, in fact. And while Larry was making a case for the stability in Africa and its potential, Colombia is often regarded in a similar favorable light. We do reports from Colombia on a fairly regular basis, partially because it ranks at or near the top of most rankings of the most promising frontier and emerging markets economy. I have Rupert Stebbings on the line from Medellin, Colombia, with a brief outlook at the economy there. He's Vice President of Equities and Research at Valores Bancolombia and has worked in equities for 19 years, starting with Robert Fleming in London, where he specialized in Asian and then Latin American markets. Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, Rupert.
Gavin, very good morning to you.
And you too. So Colombia has been amongst the emerging markets that have been hit by the sell-off that's been widespread across the whole emerging markets universe. How much did they fall? And I understand they've had a bit of a bounce recently.
Yeah, the market fell basically in line with the rest of Latin America. Until last week, we were down around 15% in dollar terms, which was in line or slightly better than Brazil and some of the other markets. The last few days have been interesting. We've had a bounce of 5 to 6%, and we've also seen the currency rally to an extent as well after being pressurized quite heavily this year. So it's an interesting inflection point. And whilst initially we were bouncing with Brazil and with the U.S., yesterday in particular we had another strong day when the U.S. and Brazil really did very little. So, yeah, we're seeing some recovery in the market right now.
And what's been driving this recent rebound? Is it just a rebound from having been so depressed, or are there actually some specific positive developments that are helping drive it?
I think there's a mixture of factors. I think one, the macro indicators for the last few weeks have actually improved. And I think there is a basic feeling here that the second half, in macro terms, will be a lot better than the first half, whether it's GDP or retail sales, industrial production. The government's stimulus plan, even though it isn't tremendously large, is having an impact on confidence, if nothing else. And secondly, the market, you know, for the first time probably in a couple of years, is that whilst it will never be a cheap market in terms of stock valuations, it is for the first time in a couple of years actually at a valuation where it's a little more appetizing for investors. So I think it's a combination of factors. I mean, locals have been very quiet, but yesterday we saw them step back into the market and start to pick up some of these names that, in their opinion at least, have been oversold.
When you say valuations are now, if not cheap, reasonable, what are we talking about in terms of a PE ratio for the market this year?
No, I mean, this is the problem. The market's always trades at a premium. We don't know where it's going to be this year. We've had a lot of new names come into the market, so putting an exact ratio on it, because it bounces around, it's been so volatile. We're in line. It's difficult to say where we are exactly because of recent moves. But we're going to be in line or around levels of Chile, which is the best benchmark. So, but it's never going to be cheap. It's never going to be a Brazil. It's never going to be a Mexico. But that's driven by growth and also by an awful lot of the companies here. They're in relatively strong market positions. You know, the top retailers or whichever sector you want to choose, they're very strong market positions, which makes them very appetizing for investors.
No, it's never a mistake to pay up for good quality growth. And as Warren Buffett said, you know, it's better to buy a great business at a reasonable price than a so-so business at a cheap price. But in terms of developments, I believe that the equity research note that your shop came out with a couple of days ago said that negotiations with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC as they're more commonly known, seem to be coming closer to a successful conclusion. Is that having a positive impact? And is that also a realistic assessment? Because obviously this has been a long, drawn-out process.
I think unquestionably you can't ignore the peace process here. Obviously, when it starts making the front page of, you know, global websites, it's obviously a very important factor. Whether it yet has a direct impact, it's more of a background noise. I mean, obviously there will be, you know, tremendous follow through in terms of economic activity if we do get a successful process. And the indications from the guerrillas at this point are that they seem to think we're coming towards an end of the conflict. But right now, for local investors especially, there's still a lot of very, very strong personalities here who are completely against the process, and obviously they make as many headlines as the other, as those supporting the process. So it's there as a background noise. It can't be ignored, and obviously there will be benefits as and when we get some kind of deal. So it is a factor, but I wouldn't say at this point it's the most important factor.
So summing things up, would it be fair to say that we had the big sell-off, we had something of a rebound, there are some positives, whether it's on the political front or whether on the macro side, and that the valuations have got to a level where certainly the locals are willing to step in. Outlook for the rest of the year, will we see more gains? Might we be back to where we started, or could we even see a market that's maybe up a little, which would obviously make it a standout as far as emerging markets are concerned?
I think the rest of the year we should see, all things being equal, and on this planet things rarely are, but all things being equal, I think we will keep moving up for the rest of the year. I think the second half macro data coming through will be a lot stronger. For example, you know, GDP, we're looking at 4.2, but of that, you know, the majority of that is coming through in the second half. We're going to see inflation tick up a little bit as activity increases. So I think as all these factors come through, for example, you know, for FDI came in 2 days ago, it was $8.6 billion for the first half. Now, that is actually accelerating as we went through the first half. It was well on target for our $17 billion estimate for this year. So the outlook is very positive, I think, for the second half.
Excellent. Well, on that positive note, we'll leave it. But thanks very much indeed, Rupert. Appreciate your updating us on what's been going on.
Gavin, always a pleasure.
Thanks. That was Rupert Stebbings on the line from Medellin, Colombia, where he's Vice President of Equities and Research at Valores Bancolombia. So when I come back from the break, we'll be checking into another area of Latin America we've been looking at over the last few weeks, this time Mexico, and we'll have a report on the outlook for consolidation amongst auto companies there and what this could mean for investors. Please stay with me for that.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
This program comes to you from the EFMI Media Company. EFMI Media is one of the most comprehensive sources of information and analysis on emerging and frontier markets. EFMI Media has become a leader in knowledge, expertise, and analysis of emerging and frontier markets, both in opportunities to investigate and pitfalls to avoid. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca or call 416-944-1750. EFMI Media produces this program, researched and wrote Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which is set for release later this year, and is currently working on a second book, also on Frontier Markets. EFMI also publishes a newsletter called EFMI Information and provides knowledgeable speakers on these and other topics. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca, or call 416-944-1750.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back. This is Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, and I'm its host, Gavin Graham. So far, we've checked the outlook for the emerging markets generally, for Africa and for Colombia. In this segment, I'm going to go to look at Mexico, which will be about the third time we've done so in the last few weeks. primarily because it's one of the most promising emerging market countries, at least partially due to its proximity to the US market. In fact, a couple of our contributors have suggested this gives it an edge over some of the other emerging markets. I have Adam Critchley on the line from Mexico City. He has covered Mexico for 15 years for numerous magazines, daily publications, and news wires. He's also the emerging market correspondent to Mexico City and a contributor to Forbes Mexico magazine. Before working in Mexico, he covered news in China and Spain. Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, Adam.
Thank you. Good morning.
Morning. We've done several segments recently on Mexico that give the impression it's actually improving as an investment destination for investors in equities. You suggested the auto market in Mexico reflects the growing health of the economy there. What's been happening as far as autos are concerned in Mexico?
Well, the car market, as a case in point, is booming. This first half of the year, in fact, has been unprecedented in terms of growth. We've had car production up by about 12%. It's basically the strength of the economy, the stability, and with the growing middle class and the expansive purchasing power. People are buying more cars, and car makers are seeing this as the best market to come and build, and also as an export base.
Of course, you have the Maquiladora factories exporting into the U.S. How much were exports to the U.S. up so far this year?
We've had 12% increase in production, and car sales are up by 9%. That's just domestically. And as I said, as an export base, exports to the U.S. are up by 11%, and also because of its strategic position geographically. It's not just reliant on the U.S. as an export market. It's obviously a bridge between North and South America and also to Asia.
So the old maxim about as goes GM or what's good for General Motors is good for the U.S., and obviously we discovered the downside of that during the most recent recession. Would it be true to make that comment about Mexico as well?
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. There's definitely a sense it's reflecting the macroeconomic stability. And the car sector in Mexico is very important to the economy. It contributes around 15% to the total manufacturing output, which is probably about $35 billion to the economy. And it's among the top 10 car producers in the world.
I'm sure that most people, if you said that to them, would be somewhat surprised, even though they might know about the large manufacturing presence in Mexico for the US market, but as you say, for other markets as well. Apart from US auto manufacturers, which other major companies are being attracted to Mexico? Obviously, the last Beetle ever made was made at a Mexican production line, but other German manufacturers and European manufacturers are also well established in Mexico. Would it be true to say?
Yes, well, with Volkswagen, they've been here nearly 60 years now. They opened their plant in 1954. They are Volkswagen models that are built here and nowhere else. So the car industry in Mexico is not the new kid on the block. There's a long tradition here of auto manufacturing, both parts and entire cars. So I think that's built up a skill set that has now put Mexico on the map as a car maker. And there are new brands coming. There's about 19 car makers working here, manufacturing here. 10 of the top brands, and there are new ones coming. Mercedes-Benz announced just this month that it's now in talks to open a plant in a kind of joint venture with Nissan, which will probably open next year, which will be building the most economical models. And of course, Audi is coming, has now laid the foundation for its new plant, so they'll be building Audi cars here. Nissan, Toyota, Honda, and then Volvo, and some truck manufacturers like Scania, for example, Dina, which is a Mexican.
So that's a pretty wide-ranging, and as you say, not merely light automobiles, but also some truck manufacturers, and the enormous knock-on effects that you get because of the major capital investment required. Presumably this is having spin-off effects for the Mexican economy as well, in terms of raising skill levels and the amount of parts and inputs that are required for these new factories.
Definitely, yeah. And there are also regulations in place which protectionist, which prevents parts makers from just using this as a springboard to the States. I think there was some concern 10, 15 years ago that this was going to become a sweatshop for the U.S., with the large U.S. automakers like General Motors and Ford having factories on this side of the border and obviously taking advantage of cheap labor and supplying the U.S. market. And that concern, I think, has now dissipated because the car makers are now serving this burgeoning domestic market and also as an export platform.
So you are getting both domestic demand and export demand. The U.S. Auto sector is picking up fairly strongly. And so it will be fair to say that that's going to help the Mexican economy in general. Do we have any sort of forecasts for growth within Mexico? Are we looking at something in the sort of 3-4% range for this year?
Yeah, there's definitely going to be growth, but I think it's going to be still moderate because obviously there's a lot of reliance on the U.S. as an export market, although Mexico is now moving away from that thanks to its free trade agreements with a plethora of countries. So it's now less reliant. There's obviously going to have a knock-on effect when there's a crisis in the U.S. I think we're now getting through that. But prospects for growth, I think, across the board, macroeconomically, are moderate. You know, there will be growth, but I think the car sector is probably the strongest. And it's definitely having a knock-on effect for the Mexican economy in the sense of creation of jobs. And I think also it's attracting investment because people are seeing it as a stable market. And obviously, as I said, with the growing middle class. And I think demand for cars is outstripping supply, which is evidenced by, for example, a new plant now being built in Aguascalientes, which is in kind of north central Mexico, which will be a supply chain for a Nissan plant. So that will bring together suppliers, manufacturers, and obviously bring local jobs and more investment.
Well, that's obviously a major factor in the improving health of the Mexican economy. The improving health of the U.S. auto sector is obviously having something of a knock-on effect. But I think, Adam, as you made the point, that the growth of this strong domestic market has certainly been a major positive development for the Mexican economy. Thanks very much indeed for bringing us up to date on this. And we hope to be able to come back to you in future editions to see how things are developing.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to Adam Critchley in Mexico City for that report on the auto sector, which, as the point you made, that it's one of the top 10 auto industries in the world, which is a fact I'm sure that is not on everyone's radar screen, and that it's obviously an area that it's worth looking at, whether it's the auto companies themselves directly or particularly those industries which are helping supply the parts and the inputs for these new plants. When I come back from the break, we'll be looking at a subject we talked about several times on Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, which is demographics. So while there are undoubtedly short-term reasons for markets becoming oversold, as most of the emerging markets have done over the last few months, or for being optimistic, as we've heard for Mexico and Colombia, demographics are the longer-term trends. So when we come back after the break, we'll be checking into demographics and the demographic dividend.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Do you like what you hear about investing in emerging and frontier markets on this program? Would you like to learn more to increase your investing effectiveness? EFMI Media also publishes a subscription-based newsletter called EFMI. We'd like to tell you more about it. Drop us an email at info@emergingfrontier.ca. We've designed EFMI as a newsletter to provide expert and up-to-date news and analysis of opportunities in the same markets that we discuss here on Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. EFMI has information and analysis that you won't find anywhere else, and you can start receiving it by emailing info@emergingfrontier.ca.
Today's business marketplace is becoming increasingly global thanks to technologies that didn't even exist a few short years ago. Your business might be a startup, or you might be one of the global 500. Either way, you're probably looking at customers and competitors in faraway regions. Listen for Global Reach with host Tay Revez as she brings together experts, ideas, and listeners to help you anywhere in the world. Global Reach is broadcast every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Save on your prescriptions with the RX Savings Plus Drug Discount Card, offered by Voice America. It is not insurance, and discounts are only available from participating pharmacies. But 9 out of 10 pharmacies participate nationwide. Start saving today. Print your free card online at voiceamerica.rxsavingsplus.com or text the word TALK RADIO to 96362.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. In previous editions of the program, you may have heard me and some of our experts talking about demographic factors, which partially explain the growth potential of emerging and frontier markets. And you'll probably heard financial advisor and researcher Peter Merrick refer to what he calls a demographic dividend as it operates in countries like China and Vietnam. Today, we're going to look at why this dividend is so important and the countries in which it makes a big difference and some where it's maybe a negative. I've got Peter on the line to help us make these distinctions. Welcome back to the program, Peter.
Thank you very much, Gavin.
So we've talked about demographics and emerging and frontier markets. Why is it such an important factor? Obviously, young populations, but if you could maybe just give us the brief Coles Notes version of the importance of the demographic dividend.
Well, one of the things about demographics is a lot of people who look at long-term believe that demographics is destiny. And as you mentioned about the demographic dividend, I just want to step back. In the 1950s, there was a study done, and they asked all the major world economists where do they believe the next potential is in the world. And most of them pointed to Africa, and they pointed to Africa because of the resources. No one really thought about Asia. And what Asia ended up doing, and we all know what it did, it invested in its people, it became very outward focused, and many of those economies have become very modern, or they've developed very quickly, and it's because of people. Now, as you asked regarding the demographic dividend, that's something which is very powerful to look at long-term developments in a country. And what the demographic dividend is it really is composed of four parts. One is the birth rate is slowing down. That means there's less children being born for women. And the reason why that's beneficial, because more investment is able to go into children, into education, to healthcare.
Yeah.
And that's very important, because the more you invest in people, the better return you get in your economy. Number two, you have access to healthcare. You have clean water. You have electricity. You have all the basic needs are taken care of and more. Education is a key. Countries are able to invest in their workers because there's less young people that they have to, you know, take care of. They have rule of law, which is key.
Yes.
Because in essence, any contract that's going to be signed, any type of foreign investment, you need rule of law. And on top of that, they're outward focused. They're not being myopic looking at themselves. For example, China until 1978 was very focused on itself, and then the main party in China decided that they were going to focus on trade, and we all know what's happened to China. Their economy went from $218 billion to last year over $8 trillion. That's incredible. We've never seen that in history, where an entire population, their standard of living in one generation, is gone up so much. So the demographics are key, And to look at a country and seeing where the opportunity is, we want to look how old the population, how educated the population, and what the rule of law is, and what is their attitude towards foreign investors and also towards trade.
But on the other side of this coin, of course, a lot of the developed countries have zero or even negative population growth, looking at Japan or Southern Europe, for example. So it would seem, just from taking the demographic point of view, that the emerging and frontier markets are likely to become much larger, a much larger weight within global GDP, just looking at the different birth rates or lack of birth rates.
Yes, because what we have to look at when an emerging market starts emerging, what happens is it's because mature markets look at those countries and say, you know, this is a great place to make toasters, microwaves, and, you know, have access to cheaper labor. What happens then is they start getting disposable income. And because if they're a younger country, the people want to start acquiring things. And then they have a consumer-based economy. And that's very powerful. We have people to sell with. When the Berlin Wall fell over 20 years ago, the European Union was so excited. They were excited because they had all these potential consumers they didn't have before.
Right.
And this is really important. Like, if you have a country that has a good economy, they're going to consume, and basically they're not going to be so focused outwards on exporting. And this is what China has been doing for the last 20 years. They've invested quite a lot into their infrastructure, building up their middle class, so they'll have their internal economy that will support them if, let's say, the United States or Europe goes into a recession, and they become a bigger part of the world, you know, GDP.
Yeah, obviously it's a difficult balancing act while you have to continue to have fairly strong exports to generate the foreign capital to invest in the infrastructure and invest in the human infrastructure that you talked about, while at the same time trying to actually have that increase in consumer spending. There are some countries, of course, and I think you maybe mentioned Russia as one which has a very negative outlook, precisely because it doesn't have that demographic dividend. Could you talk a little more about that and maybe some other countries which maybe don't look particularly attractive within the emerging market universe?
Well, what we're finding is in Europe, the average total fertility rate is about 1.3, 1.4. Now, what that the total fertility rate means, Gavin, it's how many children a woman will have in their lifetime. To maintain a culture or civilization, you need to have at least 2.1 children per woman. So what's happening in Europe, and especially in Russia, Russia is now losing about 750,000 people every year. They have a very low birth rate, and they also have one of the highest mortality rates amongst men and women anywhere in the world. So their population is actually shrinking, and some of the demographers believe that Russia's population in the next 50 years will be only two-thirds of what it is right now. So this has a huge impact because we have to look at what makes an economy, and that's people trading, and that means we need people, and we need people who are able to trade. And if there's less people, there's less trade.
Yeah, and obviously, as you say, you've got that imbalance between a growing elderly population and a shrinking working-age population to support the elderly population, even if the elderly population is living longer, as is the case in Japan, for example, and also in some of the Eastern European countries that that were liberated when the Berlin Wall came down, because the birth rates in a lot of the former Eastern Bloc countries are also either virtually non-existent or negative, I believe.
Well, when the birth rate goes down in a country, that means the country gets older. And one thing that our planet is going to have to grapple with that we've never had to look at before is by 2050, there's going to be 1.5 billion people on this planet over the age of 65. It's believed that only 300 million people who are no longer on this planet ever lived to that age. And we're talking about 95% of the population that ever made the 65 and beyond are going to be alive. And that's more people than existed in this world at the turn of the 20th century who are going to be the age of 65, and that's going to have huge impacts. And this is something, if you're looking at a long-term play, when you're looking at demographics and looking at younger populations, because that's where you have innovation, that's where you have people acquiring things, that's where, you know, you're going to get the biggest bang for your buck. It helps when you're looking at investing. It's just one factor, because there's a lot of other factors as well, because there might be an industry in a particular country, an older country that attracts young people. That might be worthwhile to invest in. But
would it be fair to say it's going to help
long-term to overlay what the demographics are of that country and looking at the dividend, because eventually a dividend can become a drag.
No, you're absolutely right, Peter. And effectively, it's fair to say that if you have those higher rates of population growth, younger populations, then you have a tailwind, which is helping the country and helping the economy. And obviously, the reverse is true if you have low or no population growth. Thanks again. We do appreciate all the insights you've given us over the last few weeks in terms of the demographic dividend. And we hope that we'll be able to come back and talk about some more countries or continents which may be of particular interest in the not too distant future.
Thank you so much, Gavin.
Appreciate it. Thanks to financial advisor and researcher Peter Merrick for that look at what's coming in some of the countries which we cover in emerging and frontier markets investing as far as their demographics are concerned. And thanks to you for being with us today. Please join us every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific, and 2 o'clock in the afternoon in the UK here on Voice America. I'm Gavin Graham. Our producer is Al Emid. We are the co-authors of Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk and Role in an Investment Portfolio, scheduled for release by John Wiley & Sons in late summer of this year, another book on frontier markets, which is set for release before the end of the year. We're also the publishers of the EFMI newsletter. For more information, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Again, that's info@emergingfrontier.ca. Thanks. Please join us each week right here.
Thanks for listening today to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with host Gavin Graham. Be sure to join us again next Wednesday at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for another edition. Have a profitable week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.